Champagne wishes and caviar dreams. That Robin Leach trademark phrase epitomizes how we feel about bubbly wine and tiny fish eggs. They signify luxury and elegance. But caviar hasn't always been food of the rich and famous. It comes from the decidedly unglamorous sturgeon, a prehistoric bottom feeder that has existed since the dinosaur age. Sturgeon can live to be 100 years old, and they never stop growing, so the longer they live, the bigger they get. Some have been known to be as long as 2 pickup trucks. But now, because of overfishing, sturgeon rarely reach maturity. In fact, they're well on their way to extinction, says Inga Saffron, author of a new book on caviar called Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy. Its very status as a delicacy, she says, while well-earned, has become its undoing.
Caviar is a very sensual experience. It's not just about the taste. It's about the texture. It's about the way it feels in your mouth. It's about the way it pops. And it releases this taste of the ocean and salt. And it's kind of nuclear in your mouth, this little explosion. And, you know, several things are going on at once, several sensual experiences. And it's delicious.
Hmm. Now, caviar didn't start out as a luxury item. I gather, was once peasant food. So how did it become associated with luxury, with exclusivity?
Well, in Russia, you know, there are a lot of rivers and seas that produce sturgeon and caviar. And so local people would naturally eat the eggs. And in the medieval times, the Orthodox Church sanctioned caviar as a food that could be eaten during meatless fast days. Orthodox Christians have to fast something like 200 days a year. So caviar was something they could eat. They began to eat that. It became something of a national dish because it was associated with the religion, with the culture. As foreigners came to Russia in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and they saw this Russian food, and they began to talk about it when they went home, it's kind of this mythical delicacy. Gradually, its reputation spread, became a fad almost. In Germany and France, people couldn't get enough of it.
And there, for a time, in your book, you say that the United States had a big caviar trade, and the headquarters was in New Jersey?
That's right. Yeah, there were a huge amount of sturgeon in American waters, in all the rivers of the East Coast and the West Coast and the Great Lakes. When the first settlers came to North America, European settlers, they saw the Indians, you know, catching these giant fish, because they are quite big, and eating them. And the Europeans were just repulsed. You know, how could you eat this horrible-looking beast? And so initially, European fishermen would throw away the sturgeon. They would give the roe to their pigs. They had absolutely no interest in it. At most, their only interest was in smoking it and, you know, feeding it to slaves or servants. It was really a despised food, like lobsters and oysters at various points. But in the 1870s, some Germans came to America, and they had a caviar business in Germany, and they were running out of fish because they had overfished them. So they came to America knowing that the sturgeon existed here, and they started paying fishermen to give them sturgeon instead of throwing them out or feeding them to their pigs. And pretty soon, these fishermen saw how much money the Germans were making from this roe that they, too, began to really fish for sturgeon and make caviar. And by the 1880s, the U.S. was exporting tons and tons of caviar to Europe. They weren't eating much of it here, but we were exporting loads of it, and we even exceeded the Russians, probably because it was easier to get to Europe from here than from Russia.
So now everything changed for the sturgeon, for the ill, as you point out in your book, after the Soviet Union split up in the early 90s. And the sturgeon then became overfished. How did that happen?
Well, during the Soviet regime, the Soviets recognized that caviar was a very valuable commodity and a very valuable industry. And like everything else, they tightly controlled it. But in 91, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was no more state, no more control, just thousands of people with no work. And so what they began to do was to fish for sturgeon and make caviar in their homes, in their kitchens. And for years and years, this was, you know, reasonably legal. And they would sell the caviar incredibly cheaply to middlemen who would then bring it to Europe or the United States. And, well, finally, some environmental organizations became concerned about this. And In 1998, they tried to restrict the export of caviar, to limit it in an effort to control this rapacious fishing that was taking place in the Caspian and in the Black Sea and in the Amur River and wherever there were sturgeon in the former Soviet Union.
And were they successful?
Mildly successful, but what the CITES, it's called, is this international environmental group, and it can regulate the trade, it can regulate the exports, which it's done fairly successfully, but it can't regulate the fishing in Russia and or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, and those countries haven't shown much of a willingness to control the fishing. So although the exports are controlled, the actual fishing isn't controlled. So now you can go to Moscow and you can see, you know, a pound of caviar selling for $15. I think it's a really serious situation, particularly for the beluga, which is the biggest and the most primitive of the sturgeon, probably the most ancient. And, you know, the word is that there's maybe a couple thousand beluga left in the sea. Its population has really just been destroyed.
Inga Saffron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Inga Saffron is the author of Caviar, The Strange History and Uncertain Future of the World's Most Coveted Delicacy.